Welcome to the PeaceWorks Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Moles. I'm a pastor and biblical counselor who helps churches and families confront the evil of domestic violence and promote healthy, God-honoring relationships. Welcome back to the PeaceWorks Podcast, everyone. On today's episode, we're going to be answering your questions about separation and divorce and abuse. But before we jump into that topic, I want to take a moment to remind you of PeaceWorks University. PeaceWorks University is our online membership community, and it is a thriving community of people helpers attempting to apply gospel-centered solutions to the problem of domestic abuse. If you are benefiting from the content you're receiving week after week on the PeaceWorks podcast, then PeaceWorks University is your best next step. You can find out more about PeaceWorks University and all of the services that we offer at chrismoles.org. All right, so today we're going to address a commonly asked question. I know we've talked about it on the podcast before, but we're going to revisit the idea of separation and divorce. The question comes in, the questioner asks if we could just give some communicate a little bit about divorce in cases of abuse as well as separation using the scriptures. And this is a common discussion that's happening among helpers, especially counselors that I'm talking with that are having difficulty engaging in these conversations, one, with their pastor or ministry leaders, or two, are having difficulty theologically unpacking some of the concerns that they have with leaders who are much more versed in, say, the scriptures and specific theological positions. On the outset, let me say this, because this is something that I did not anticipate when I began to get asked questions about this. I always preface when I talk about abuse, divorce, separation, that there's a wide spectrum of beliefs about divorce that all fall within historical orthodoxy. Like if you were to put the views on divorce on a line, most of them fall within a framework that you can support biblically. What I mean by that is there are good people on variety, on many different sides of this discussion. Those who, you know, are permanence view folks have a very scripturally supported position. We might disagree, but they're good people in that camp. There are two exception folks, typically is what they're called, individuals who believe in the opportunity for divorce among believers for abandonment or adultery. There are some who would say the categories are much broader, scripturally speaking. There are some who believe that there's no divorce, no remarriage. Some who believe you can get divorced but not get remarried. Others who believe you can get divorced and remarried within the Christian church, all supported from scriptural positions, different points of view. And so from the outset, I always like to say, I think there are good people with good hermeneutics that are disagreeing, and I don't think this needs to be as divisive as it is. However, it is. And the criticism that I often receive whenever I'm asked this question or we talk about this question is that because my view may be different from another person's view, that I'm therefore unbiblical. And I don't think that's a fair assessment for me. I don't think it's a fair assessment for folks who disagree with me. I think the primary concern is no matter where you fall on the spectrum, if you're a no-no, a yes-no, yes-yes, yes-yes with caveats, whatever divorce and biblical teaching position you hold within those categories, how are you operating practically to keep people safe? That's the real question. That's the primary question. And so I will admit that I'm not a permanence view person. However, I work with permanence churches, have for many years. And so when I'm working with a permanence church, someone who believes that there's no justification or biblical grounds for divorce, there's no biblical grounds, therefore, for remarriage, my question to them is not, how can I change your theology? Because I think that's a battle that you can't win, first of all, and I do think in many ways it's an unnecessary fight. My question is, okay, how will you practically care for victims of domestic abuse and sexual assault within marriage while holding that view? The burden then, I think, increases. Your theological position on divorce doesn't free you from providing for safety, or it doesn't end with your pronouncement, your theological pronouncement. That's the beginning. How will it practically affect the ways you respond? Because none of us, I hope anyway, although there are some folks out there, I think, who would, they would maybe pop off or say things quickly without giving it real heart thought. I don't think that most of us are looking for means to keep people in harm's way. And so if our theological position doesn't allow for divorce or separation to be a tool in our tool belt, okay, how then will we provide for the safety of those who are being harmed in their home? That's an important question, and it's one that we should be discussing. How will our practical theology impact victims and perpetrators? Not just how our held theology perhaps inadvertently harms or helps. So keep that in mind as we move forward. So the questioner really is kind of looking for position, I think, on the subject. So I'm just going to lay this out once again. This is something that I've talked about before, but I'm just going to walk us through just some principles that I use. And the first is really you have to have, in my opinion, a theology of abuse before you develop a theology of abuse and divorce. And you really need to understand what abuse is. And I'm not going to be able to unpack that completely, but let's just agree on the principles that abuse, first of all, is the use of power to dominate or control another person, right? So it's intentional, it's in a pattern, and it's designed to control. And abuse, therefore, you know, as this power over dynamic, violates the image of God in the other person, violates the image of God physically, if you're physically assaulting, emotionally, we emote because God emotes, relationally, we relate because God relates. So the image of God is affected, violated through abuse. We are harming an image bearer. Second, violates the will of God. God's given very clear instructions, in particular to husbands, to love their wives, to serve their wives, to be considerate with their wives. I'm always fascinated at how we struggle with principles of abuse sometimes within our conversations, and yet God's been very clear of his disdain or his dislike, his displeasure for harshness, for instance, in Colossians chapter 3, for being inconsiderate, 1 Peter chapter 3, for being unloving, Ephesians chapter 5. And of course, if that's true, how much more serious is the sin of abuse? Because it violates the very will of God, his clear direction for husbands. And then third, it violates his heart. I think we would all agree that God is not abusive, that he seeks to use power to serve, Jesus being the ultimate example of that. He calls his disciples to power under. He models it throughout his ministry here on earth and before and after his earthly ministry. If you consider things like Philippians 2 and just the servant leadership principles that Jesus taught us, modeled for us, and then called us to. So it violates the image of God. Abuse violates the will of God, violates the heart of God. So when abuse is present, what are some things that we believe practically if abuse is sin and a very hardened, unique, destructive form of sin? Well, first, the question comes a lot of times with counselors and pastors is, do you support separation? And I'm going to say yes. I think separation is a reasonable request, a reasonable option for an individual whose safety is in danger, somebody who's in harm's way. So when there's a lack of safety, someone is at risk. They are subjected to potential harm, physical or otherwise. Separation could be a reasonable offer or resource for them. Now, understand that victims may not wish to separate. They may actually feel more comfortable in close proximity, even in physically abusive relationships. Understanding that perhaps the certainty of his presence is more comforting or tolerable than the mystery of his absence. So don't assume that separation will occur, and that's the primary means of safety. It certainly will help. However, not being in your abuser's presence provides a great deal of mystery. Will he show up? Where is he? What's he doing? And that type of uncertainty can leave victims more frustrated. So don't be surprised if a victim chooses to stay in close proximity. I would say separation's warranted as well when physical problems in the body due to emotional and extreme stress are present. So health concerns and functioning related to the stress. And I'll give you some examples. I've worked with men over the years whose wives have developed autoimmune disorders that have really compromised their physical health, or perhaps neglect and abuse have contributed to malnutrition, have contributed to eating disorders, or have contributed to health concerns that need to be addressed by a physician. That the best thing for this couple is for them to experience time apart, because their time together is creating health concerns for the victim. And that can include things like increased stress that affects one's heart, one's overall health, things like I talked about earlier about malnutrition or autoimmune disorders or other aspects of health that are negatively affected from the abuse or the neglect, and it becomes unbearable. And so maybe the best thing is to remove the individual so they can be properly cared for and become healthy again. And that also can include aspects of trauma that are eliminating an individual's ability to function. We talk in biblical counseling about effective function. And so trying to get individuals back into the discipleship river is one thing we might talk about. And so if your raft, for instance, of life has encountered rapids, encountered destruction, you need to get to the eddy of safety. You need to get to the still waters to reassemble the raft, get all your gear back together, and prepare yourself to head back into the flow of life. And we talk about that regularly in aspects of intensive discipleship, but I would also throw out there the potential of removal and separation. We do this with addiction by turning to treatment centers and facilities that are going to help us. We do this sometimes with combat veterans who need time away. So perhaps they need a reacclimation period. So I'm going to suggest that victims of domestic violence, more than likely, even if it's not physical violence, have been affected traumatically in a way that separation could be a healthy part of the discipleship river from a counseling perspective. The other thing to consider here is this is when we cross over into the divorce argument, because often what I'll hear is, well, Chris, if you green light separation, it's a slippery slope to divorce. And I don't know that I would even that terminology puts a higher priority on marriage restoration than it does on safety and even reconciliation to God, I think. Because separation, as I just laid out, is not about ending the marriage. It's about protecting one individual. I guess the other reason, let me back up for just a second, because I guess the other thing that separation could be good for is consequences. Sometimes that type of consequence can get an abuser's attention, although I hate to weaponize consequences. I think they are just, in many ways, natural results of our sin. But that's something to keep in mind. So let's get back. So the slippery slope idea is that we're opening the door for divorce. And I don't think so. I think what we're doing is we're prioritizing safety for the vulnerable. I would hate to leave someone in a situation where their capacities would be diminished in such a way that they would, you know, lose themselves, or they would be completely destroyed by this other individual. And remember, abuse is a sin, violating the image of God, the will of God, and the heart of God. A couple of scriptures that get discussed when we bring up abuse and divorce. The first is I think it's an easy discussion to have is Malachi 2:16. It comes up quite a bit. God hates divorce. I think it's a bumper sticker in evangelicalism more than a theological framework. The reason why I bring that up is the context of the passage is pretty easy to argue. So if that comes up in a discussion, I mean, one of the things that I would consider doing is just talking through the totality of the passage and then really, really understanding the context of Malachi 2 as a indictment on treacherous husbands who are shamelessly putting away their partners to engage in intimacy and relationships with foreign women, in idolatrous type relationships. And so it's that context in which God condemns divorce. It could be said that, because the language is really odd in this passage, some would say that the language actually says, I hate a man who divorces his wife treacherously. Others would say, I hate a man who uses divorce as a violent act, the idea that this divorce is coercive and controlling, so therefore it's violent, that the husband should be protecting, not violating, or the man who hates his wife and divorces her, that the hatred actually belongs to the man. It's an easier passage to argue because the God hates divorce, one, it may not be a great translation. Two, it might not be the certificate of divorce that God hates. He's the one who instituted it, so it's not like he's contradicting himself here. I hate what I created. More than likely, he hates either the way the divorce is coming about, he hates the way in which the divorce is being utilized, or he's talking about the man's hatred for his wife, but it doesn't seem that God himself is hating divorce. And of course, if you read the entire passage of Malachi chapter 2, I think it becomes clear. I don't think that's an arguable passage. I think it's a very clever bumper sticker that's easy for us to throw out there because we don't like divorce. And so instead of arguing for the sanctity and the protection of marriage from a biblical perspective, it's just easier to condemn divorce rather than promote biblical marriage. So I would say that's where the conversation sometimes goes. I don't think that that's a difficult conversation to navigate because I'm not sure we can argue that we're talking about the same thing, right? So keep that in mind. Malachi 2, not a great passage for that. The other passages, if you're talking about, what is it, Mark 10, Matthew 19 maybe, I don't have the references in front of me, but in the Gospels, Jesus seems to be addressing the specific argument from the religious leaders regarding the passage in Deuteronomy 24, where the Pharisees, I think it's in Mark 10, the language says, some Pharisees came and tested Jesus. So they're putting Jesus, they're trying to trick him, which is what they typically do, and they're bringing up Deuteronomy 24. Deuteronomy 24 is the passage that says, if a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him, and he finds something indecent about her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and gives it to her, he can send her from the house. The idea here is that a certificate of divorce is to be issued in this context for something indecent. Now, there was one school, we'll call the easy school of thought that they're testing Jesus with, who is saying, okay, so anything indecent, like anything I don't like, so if you burn dinner, I can divorce you. And then there was another school that was like, no, it's the rigid school. And it was this idea of it has to be adultery and you have to put them away. It's like an all or nothing type thinking. And of course, Jesus, as being the master of the third way, really identifies in the New Testament this idea of, you know, Moses gave you this because of the hardness of men's hearts. So the first thing is this idea that the certificate of divorce is really about hard-heartedness. It's about God's protection of the vulnerable. So divorce was not necessarily a breaking of the covenant. Divorce was a tool that was given to the vulnerable when the covenant was broken. And I think that's an important concept, is that sometimes I'll hear people say, you know, Chris, you're promoting divorce, and I don't like divorce. I don't want to see divorce. But divorce is not the breaking of the covenant. Divorce is like the consequence of a broken covenant in many cases. And I think that's why Moses, or God through Moses, gave the people the certificate of divorce, is to protect individuals from covenant-breaking activity. He goes on to talk about this idea from Moses. He cites the created order, which is really important, the, you know, God's establishment of marriage, about men and women being united in marriage. Then he talks a little bit about adultery and some other concepts here. I think the important principle that we all can agree on, at least I think we can all agree on, is that Jesus is not succumbing to the easy view of divorce by saying that you can just get divorced willy-nilly, but he's coming down on the necessity of having a biblical marriage, two people committed to the covenant, and that covenant breaking, and in this case, specifically, adultery being the covenant breaker, is what we're talking about. Not how or when or the importance of the certificate, but that the certificate of divorce was a tool used to protect those from covenant-breaking activity, and in this case, specifically, adultery. Now, Chris, why do you say specifically adultery? Because there's other case law that's not being mentioned here. Jesus is only addressing the Deuteronomy case law. The other big passage that doesn't get much play in the New Testament, and this is where we're going to agree to disagree, because in many ways, this is an argument from silence, because the Exodus 21 passage gets no play. I think it's got one little possible reference in the New Testament, but it gets so little play in large part because it seems to be widely held and widely agreed upon. And that's the case of the slave wife, right? Exodus 21, if he marries another woman. So this guy married a woman. He gets a second wife later on. He must not deprive the first one of food, clothing, or marital rights. That's sexual activity. If he does not provide her with these three things, she's free to go without payment of money. The idea here is she's free to leave if he neglects her. So neglect seems to be an Old Testament principle that warranted divorce, in particular for women who were not being cared for. And that's where we get our basic marriage vows, to love, honor, cherish, is this concept of abandoning neglect and embracing care. And I think that's reiterated in 1 Corinthians 7. Paul seems to reference provision, and he certainly references sexuality and sexual union when he talks about this idea of covenant keeping and abandonment. So those of us who are two exception people will usually say it's very clear adultery is a grounds for divorce. Doesn't have to lead to divorce, but certainly that tool is there to protect the vulnerable from covenant breaking. But secondly is abandonment or desertion, according to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. For many of us, we would say that if abandonment and desertion, defined by an unwillingness to live at peace with your partner, coinciding with what seems to be a very similar passage in Exodus 21, it seems like Paul's got this in his mind when he's writing, neglect, abandonment, desertion, breaking of the covenant would all fall into these categories of having the ability, the grounds, to leave that situation, to seek safety, health, hope, freedom. Now again, let me back all the way up to the beginning, because I know we're running over time today. Some will hear that and they'll get very upset. Well, Chris is not biblical because I don't agree with the position maybe that you hold or your church holds. And that's okay. Again, I come back. This view sits on a spectrum, and a lot of us can agree to disagree. The real important question that we have to ask ourselves is, practically, how does our theology then lead us to care for those who are being harmed, neglected in their home? Are we still caring for those who are being hurt, or are we arguing about our theology? Now, granted, it's going to look different, whatever position that we hold, but that's just a brief look, not even a thorough look, but because of time, just a brief look at some of the passages that I interact with to come to the conclusions that I do, that divorce is a tool in the tool belt. It's the last one that we use. It's certainly not the most frequently that we pull out. But when we do, we want to be careful. We want to be skilled. And we want to use every tool in the tool belt to care for those who are hurting, to address suffering with compassion, to bring healing and hope to those who are being hurting, and accountability to those who are oppressing and harming. And certainly aspects of separation, possibly aspects of divorce, could be part of that process. So I hope that helps. I hope that helps clarify the question. Again, just because I hold that position doesn't mean that your church or your pastor will hold that position. And again, the burden lies not in our ability to convince somebody to theologically shift their view, but the burden lies in how do we practically take what we believe and care for those who are being harmed, leaving the individual in a situation to be harmed is not necessarily the answer. Responding with compassion and presence and hope is the only real opportunity that we have to see change, no matter what position that we hold. Cool. So our theology of abuse will determine our response. And then our theology of divorce will affect the tools that we use and bring to bear on the situation. Well, I hope that was helpful. I know we've gone a little longer than normal. Thank you so much for being part of the Peaceworks podcast. Please rate, review, subscribe, let the platform know that you're listening. We thank you so much for being part of our community. And until next time, folks, God bless.